Bible Worm, Bible Worm, reading the Bible with Bible Worm.
Welcome to Bible Worm, getting to the core of the biblical text. I'm Dr. Robert Williamson, professor of religious studies at Hendricks College and the founding pastor of Mercy Community Church in Little Rock.
And I'm Dr. Amy Robertson, director of lifelong learning at Congregation Or Hadash in Sandy Springs, Georgia. We're here every week to discuss the biblical text, both as biblical scholars and as people of faith, one Jewish and one Christian.
This week we read the story of Palm Sunday in Luke 19:29-44. Except in this version there are no palms and no one shouts Hosanna. Can we even call it Palm Sunday? We talk about Jesus orchestrating a donkey jacking and the implicit claim that Jesus is Lord of all. We comment on the tenderness of the people in the midst of a tragic story as they lift Jesus up on a colt and spread their cloaks in front of him. And we wrestle with our addiction to systems of violence which prevent us from living in peace if we cannot manage to see God in our midst. Thanks for joining us. Hey, Amy, how are you this week?
I am doing all right. How are you?
I'm doing really great. This week, we're in the Palm Sunday text in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 19, verses 29 to 44. This is not the usual Palm Sunday text. There's actually no palms in this text. I don't know.
That's true. There is a profound absence of palms in this.
So I don't know what, maybe this week year we can't call it Palm Sunday. We've got to call it like Cloak Sunday or something.
Donkey Sunday, can we call it that?
Hee-haw. Okay, we're a week before Easter in the gospel narrative. So Jesus is coming in. He's been traveling to Jerusalem since Luke 9:51. So for 10 chapters of the gospel, he's been headed toward Jerusalem, and now he's finally arriving.
Yeah.
And his life only lasts for a week after this text, so yeah.
Yeah, we're really reaching this sort of, you know, fever pitch.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly right. So I'm picking up in Luke chapter 19, verse 29. As Jesus came to Bethphage and Bethany on the Mount of Olives, he gave two disciples a task. He said, "Go into the village over there. When you enter it, you will find tied up there a colt that no one has ever ridden. Untie it and bring it here. If anyone asks, 'Why are you untying it?' just say, 'Its master needs it.' Those who had been sent found it exactly as he had said. As they were untying the colt, its owners said to them, 'Why are you untying the colt?' They replied, 'Its master needs it.'"
This is such an interesting detail to include, I think.
Yeah. Say more about that.
So the fact that he has to ride in on a colt in the first place is an interesting detail, but that detail is echoing a verse from Zechariah, right, where it, in Zechariah 9:9, it describes the king as coming into Jerusalem riding on a colt like this. And so that is a sort of, I don't know, this is sort of a crude phrase, but I sort of see it as like a check the box. Like,
yeah.
Look, this is another way that we can be sure that the king is the king, is Jesus, you know, is the Messiah, and sort of wrap all those things together. But the additional layer of Jesus knowing where there will be a colt.
Yeah.
And telling his people to go get the colt and then telling them, telling them exactly how the whole scenario is going to play out. And it plays out exactly that way. That just seems, I just think that's really interesting. What do you make of all that?
Yeah, no, there's a lot going on in this first little section of the text for sure. And, you know, you're pointing to Zechariah 9, which I think is really important. And in that text, you get, that the king, the Messiah, is going to come riding into Jerusalem in Zechariah, humble and riding on an ass, on a colt, the offspring of a donkey.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in the Greek, that offspring of a donkey, the word is a new donkey, and which is where I think you get the detail in this text that he's a donkey that nobody's ever ridden before.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And so, like, so that detail's interesting. And then the fact that he's a borrowed donkey, or like a really, he's like, it's almost like a donkey jacking. You know what I mean? Like,
it's pretty weird. Yeah. I find it interesting that Jesus says, some people might ask you and just tell them the Lord needs it. And then the text says, the owners asked.
Yeah.
That's different than some people.
Yeah.
And the owners just seem to be like, okay, yeah, cool.
The CEB translation, one of the reasons that I sort of hesitated a minute ago is the CEB translation uses the word master instead of lord. But it is lord, and the owners, the word there is also kurioi. So the lords of the donkeys said, what are you doing? And they said, its owner needs it. Like, its kurios needs it, right? And so there's this play on the, like, who's the legitimate kurios of this donkey? And the owner, the owners seem to recognize that somehow Jesus's claim of ownership is supersedent to their claim of ownership, even though they clearly own the donkey.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
Now, then there's also the predictive element, which I think you were sort of pointing to at the very beginning of our conversation about, like, Jesus tells the disciples, go, and this is what you're going to find when you get there. And then they go, and that's what they find.
Yeah.
What do you do with that prophecy fulfillment motif?
I mean, I guess my first, the first thought that comes to me is that it really reminds me that Jesus knows what's going to happen to him.
Yeah.
On this trip.
Yeah.
And it's a funny thing for him to be in the position of helping it to unfold, you know, to be instructing people in what they're going to need to do in order for it to unfold the way that it needs to unfold.
Yeah.
But that's the position. Like, that's that's the job.
Yeah.
And he's doing it. It certainly is prophecy and fulfillment, but I didn't think of it quite in the same way as prophecy. I thought of it in terms of he's walking through this most difficult part of his story and facilitating it and not running from it.
Yeah, I think that's really well said. And he's been talking about this since 951 when he set his face toward Jerusalem.
Yeah.
He's been telling people, here's what's going to happen. Here's what's going to happen. And so it's no surprise here. You're exactly right that he knows what's going to happen and that he is doing his part to make things move forward. I think that's important.
Yeah. Yeah.
I also wonder if that, you know, what I call the prophetic element, because there is a little bit of, like, you know, hey, there's going to be a donkey tied up, that is like a slight foretelling of the future, right? Like, very slight, you know, it's like a 2-hour prophecy or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which could be for the reader reassuring that when Jesus says, this is what's going to happen, this is what's going to happen.
Yes.
So when he says, here's a donkey and there's a donkey, then when he says, there's going to be a resurrection, then you think, okay, Jesus knows what he's talking about.
Well, there was a donkey.
Yeah. Yeah. Luke is establishing Jesus's credibility in some kind of way here.
I could totally see that. I could see that. I think relatedly, but I have this comparison in my head of, okay, this is a little weird, but you know these, like, well, you probably don't know because you don't live with tweens who watch TikTok videos all the time, but sometimes, like, my daughter will watch TikTok videos that she just watches because she calls them satisfying, and it's just like watching something messy being totally cleaned up or watching some task being, like, completed perfectly.
I'd be like, kid, like, go wash the dishes, like,
yeah,
there's right, all kinds of right. things you could do that would result in satisfying cleanliness.
I know, but then you can't sit on the couch and do that. But I feel in this text also a sense of, like, just as Zechariah said this was going to happen, it happened. And just as Jesus said it was going to happen, it happened. And even the detail of the people that he sends to go get the colt say exactly the words that he said to say. Like, it just feels, it's very satisfying.
Yeah.
Like, it's very, everything is unfolding as it should.
Yeah. Now, in the first verse here, 29, we get the setting, which is Jesus is coming to Bethphage and Bethany on the mountain called Olives. Like, what do we need to know about that setting?
I mean, the Mount of Olives is this hill that is opposite Jerusalem, very close to Jerusalem, and the sort of on the eastern side.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, again, from Zechariah, it is the traditional place where the Messiah appears. So there's a known association with this location near Jerusalem and the Messiah. That's from Zechariah 14.
So we've got two references here to Zechariah then, both of them with sort of messianic implications. Mm-hmm. One is riding in on a colt and the other is at the Mount of Olives.
Yeah.
So you can kind of hear, like, oh, mm-hmm. we're setting up for the arrival of a king. Mm-hmm. And this is something that's been unfolding this whole time, and now it's about to happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so then picking up in verse 35. They brought it to Jesus, threw their clothes on the colt, and lifted Jesus onto it. As Jesus rode along, they spread their clothes on the road. As Jesus approached the road leading down from the Mount of Olives, the whole throng of his disciples began rejoicing. They praised God with a loud voice because of all the mighty things they had seen. They said, "Blessings on the King who comes in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven and glory in the highest heavens." So what I understand is happening here is the disciples, and this might be bigger than the 12, and at one point here it's a multitude or a throng in the CEB, but initially they drape the colt with their clothes, and then they're laying out like their overcoats or whatever, their tunics on the road in front of him. And so the colt is walking along on their clothes instead of touching the ground. Is that what you understand is happening?
Yeah, that's what I understand.
Can you talk a little bit about like what's going on with that practice? Like, what does it signify?
I mean, I think that at a sort of most basic level, it's this way of really tremendously honoring the person. And it, you know, it's one thing to put your cloak in front of the person as they're walking so their feet don't touch the dirty ground. And we see something like this in 2 Kings, this sort of practice of like putting your cloak in front of the king so they can,
yeah,
you know, almost like, you know, like we see in, I feel like it's a cartoon move now, but, you know, putting your cloak over a mud puddle so that your beloved doesn't have to dirty their feet in the mud puddle. But I mean, I feel like putting it in front of the colt is just other level of,
yeah,
of honor. I mean, it's not like these people had so much clothing or say a washing machine at home, or I don't know. I find this very, it's like, it's such a tender image to me, like this excess of honor and the juxtaposition of humility and honor in this scene. And like, it's just a random colt that they just borrowed. Like, it's not like the colt has been cared for in a special way or like has fancy shoes on that have to stay clean.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's this, I find it very tender. Do you see more in it than that? Like, are there other resonances for you?
No, I love that. And yeah, that image in 2 Kings 9 is when Jehu is the king. And you're right, they're putting it under Jehu's feet. And I had not made that connection, but I love it about the like the next levelness of doing it. Like, Jesus' feet are not going to touch the ground anyway because he's
right.
sitting on
he's already on the
colt that has yeah. itself been cloaked. So he doesn't even,
yes.
he's not even touching the,
yes.
the animal.
Yes.
So the people here, initially, it seems to be some of Jesus' closer followers are doing this. And then mm-hmm. as they kind of come over the ridge and start down from the Mount of Olives, we get the notice in 37, the whole throng of his disciples began rejoicing. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, my question is, who is in this crowd in Luke's telling of the story?
It is interesting for me to have that juxtaposition of throng and disciples. Like, this is not just a random crowd of people. These are people who see themselves as students of Jesus. And there are a lot of them in Jerusalem already. So I guess this wouldn't be a crowd of people that came with him, right? It would be a crowd of people who was already there, who had heard about him waiting for him. Is that how you would think about that?
That's how I read it. Yeah. And in some of the other gospels, there are like just people who come streaming out, like in John, they come out from Jerusalem, like they're welcoming him, even though they don't seem to have known him before. And that's not what seems to be happening here.
Yeah.
This is very specific that these are disciples of Jesus. And as you're noticing, that there is a throng of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they're not people who've never heard of Jesus before. They're people who already are followers of Jesus in some way. So this crowd, what they're shouting as Jesus comes in is, "Blessings on the King who comes in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven and glory in the highest heavens." Mm-hmm. What do you make of what they're saying there?
Well, I mean, it seems to pull from a couple, from at least two places in the Hebrew Bible. One of them is Zechariah 9, again, that we just looked at in that scene where where the Messiah is riding in. And then the other is from Psalm 118.
Which part comes from Zechariah 9?
Well, you know, it may be that that reference is felt more strongly, like, right before they start talking, focusing on this, like, joyful shout. Because Zechariah 9:9 has a, you know, rejoice greatly,
yeah.
Zion, raise a shout, because your king is coming, you know?
Oh, I see what you're saying. So it's not what they're saying there, it's that they're there rejoicing.
Yeah, it's like the stage notes. This is the way you should say it.
Yeah. And then the other one you're saying is Psalm 118?
Yeah. Psalm 118, verse 26. May he who enters be blessed in the name of the Lord. Sort of. So it's the combination of, like, blessed is the king. We know it's the king because of Zechariah 9:9. Yeah. Who comes in the name of the Lord is, you know, maybe from that psalm.
Yeah, I think that's interesting that, so a couple of things with that reference to Psalm 118. The one who enters in the Lord's name is blessed. And so they've taken that, but they've amplified it, right? And they've said, The one who's coming is the king, right? So
Not just the one. Yeah. He's not just a dude on a donkey. Yeah.
Yeah. So in case you missed what's happening here, the people are naming it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Loud and proud. Yeah, that's exactly right. And then the other place, like, where that's familiar is from a text we read just a couple of weeks ago in Luke 13, in that little section in 13:35. When Jesus is weeping over Jerusalem and he says, I tell you, you won't see me until the time comes when you say blessings on the one who comes in the Lord's name. And then and then here we are, like, that's what's happening here. And now some of the people understand. Yeah. Now, I think that probably also has a, like, a future messianic sense in which at the return of the Messiah, more people are going to realize. But here we have a little bit of a fulfillment of that sort of prophecy. Anyway, that statement of Jesus in 13:35.
Yeah. Fulfillment within this gospel itself.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are a couple things that are missing in this telling of Palm Sunday, which I don't know if they would stand out to you if you're not somebody who, like, practices Palm Sunday every year. But the two things that I noticed that are missing are, one, there's no palms in this story. So the people are spreading their cloaks, but they're not spreading out palms and they're not waving palms. And the other one is in Mark, they shout Hosanna in the highest. And here they're not shouting Hosanna. They're shouting blessings on the king who comes in the name of the Lord. Mm-hmm. Do you have any insight into the nature, like, what do those changes do to the story, like, relative to the other versions of this story?
Well, you are right to identify that I didn't miss those things because I don't know the other gospels as well as you do.
Yeah, of course.
But it seems a little more humble, a little more muted.
Yeah.
Like, just the image of waving palms is, I don't know, it like raises up the sense of grandeur about it. This is a highly honoring thing that is happening, but it doesn't seem grand.
Yeah.
But what do you think, you who have been reading these stories all your life?
You know, one other way of reading it is that palm branches have a nationalistic interpretation to them in first century Judaism. So when you read in Maccabees, when they celebrate the arrival of the Maccabees, you know, they're waving palm branches and it's sort of a, like, an overthrow the Greeks and reestablish, you know, Jewish rule over Israel. The palm branches have that kind of significance. And so might Hosanna, the sort of shout of, you know, save us. Mm-hmm. And so one way of reading what Luke is doing here is he's giving us the messianic interpretation of Jesus' arrival in Jerusalem, but he's taking away the nationalistic sort of flavor of the arrival of the Messiah. So he's doing something different than saying, here comes the king who's going to be the, you know, the king who's going to restore Israel. And he's saying something more like, here comes the king who is the king of a whole different realm. Like, he's the king of the kingdom of God.
Yeah.
And he's not about overthrowing the Romans and establishing Jewish rule over Israel.
That's really interesting. I think that's really interesting.
So as the people are shouting and laying their cloaks on the ground, we pick up in verse 39. Some of the Pharisees from the crowd said to Jesus, "Teacher, scold your disciples. Tell them to stop." He answered, "I tell you, if they were silent, the stones would shout." Okay, so here we have the Pharisees again, kind of you know, they are forever in Luke's gospel scolding Jesus for something.
Yes.
What do you think's their concern here?
I mean, it does seem like it would be dangerous to have people proclaiming the king is coming. Like, it seems like it would be dangerous to Jesus. And I don't know if the Pharisees have his well-being in mind or not, but even if the Pharisees are just trying not to rock the boat, which they seem disinclined to the rocking of the boat, this seems like a very disruptive thing that is happening.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Like, the Romans' ability to distinguish, like, Jesus's followers are doing one thing, but, like, this is not the Jews that are revolting. This is, like, a little sect within Judaism that is revolting.
Right.
Like, the Romans don't parse things that carefully.
Yeah, they don't care about that. Differentiation, yeah. Uh-huh.
So the Pharisees are, I mean, I think legitimately worried, like, not just for their own safety, but, like, for the safety of Jerusalem and the safety of all the people. Like, you are... I mean, we're at Passover, right? This is a time when, like, it was ripe for political revolution, and, like, it was kind of a tense time in Jerusalem anyway. And here comes this guy riding on a colt with people spreading cloaks before the donkey and shouting,
yeah.
You know, here comes the king.
Right, blessed is the king.
Yeah.
Right.
So you can absolutely see why the Pharisees are saying, like, hold on. And, I mean, what you're saying about maybe they're concerned about Jesus, they are certainly concerned about themselves. They are, I mean, I think concerned just about, like, stability of the social order and, like, protecting Jerusalem from being destroyed.
Yes. Yes. This is a highly destabilizing scene.
Now, Jesus says, if they were silent, the stones would shout.
I love that line so much.
What is it? Where do you go with it?
I mean, I just, like, there's this sense of urgency about this truth that is going to come out. Like, the whole, like, all of creation is, like, trembling with this truth. And, you know, there are, like, there's a line in Habakkuk, and there are lines in Psalms and that are about sort of creation in some way, like, crying out God's kingship or, you know, extolling the Lord in the world. And just hearing, like, if they were quiet, the stones would cry out. Like, I think I used the phrase earlier that we're at a fever pitch, but, like, the whole of creation is vibrating with the intensity of this truth. And you can't, whatever the consequences are of it, it's gonna come out. Like, it's out. It's so beautiful.
I love that language. The whole of creation is vibrating with this truth. That's beautiful. Yeah. And you get a sense, too, of the, like, the cosmic nature of the kingship that's being proclaimed here. This is not simply a political kingship over the political entity that is Jerusalem, Judea. This is, like, a cosmic kingship that affects the whole of creation. Mm-hmm.
I don't know why it stood out to me so much, but in this scene where they've got this colt and they lay their shirts or whatever over the colt, and then it says they set Jesus on it.
Mm.
And for some reason, I'm just really struck by, like, Jesus is a grown man.
Yeah.
They put, like, and the fact that the actors there are the people around Jesus and not Jesus himself just for some reason, like, flashed me back to, like, Jesus as a swaddled baby and as a child. And flashed me back to, like, Isaac and Abraham. And I don't know, this sense of care for him, or I don't know, this, like, juxtaposition of, like, huge honor and parenting in a way, you know, like, I don't know, the way that the crowd lifted him and put him on the colt. I don't know what to do with that. I love it, and it makes me very uncomfortable because I know, you know, as I keep, like, I know where this is all going, and the people don't know where it's going. You know, I assume, but, you know, there are rabbinic stories, midrashim, that see Isaac as a knowing participant in going up the mountain with Abraham. And I don't know, it makes it feel so human to me. It drops me, like, right back, not just into this idea of, like, Jesus as Lord and powerful teacher and, like, person who's gonna, like, change the systems and overthrow unfair things, but just as a person who is going to suffer and is, you know, heading into a really difficult fate. And I don't know, it just makes it, it makes it sad for me.
Yeah.
It adds an element of sadness to the joy.
Yeah, I really love that. And you flash back from the lifting up to Jesus as an infant. You could also flash forward from the lifting up onto the donkey to the lifting up on the cross. Mm-hmm. And so the next time the people lift up Jesus, they're going to be crucifying him.
Oh, gosh.
And so there's this like, and there you have that same idea back to the binding of Isaac, that he knows what's happening. He's participating in it willingly. He's being lifted up in honor here. He's going to be lifted up in death there, which is, I mean, turns out to have been an honor on the other side of the story. But yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot there. I love that. Where you point us there to the tenderness, the sadness of the story, I think is really important. And oftentimes Palm Sunday can be interpreted. I mean, and even in, you know, the Bibles that you read, often the title of the subtitle of this little section is like the triumphal entry. And you're capturing really nicely there that there is a sense of triumph to the entry, but it's not only triumph. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I'm grateful for in the narrative lectionary, and I'm not always grateful for the narrative lectionary's text divisions, but I am very grateful that they include in the Palm Sunday text this next little section in 1941 to 44. As Jesus came to the city and observed it, he wept over it. He said, "If only you knew on this of all days the things that lead to peace, but now they are hidden from your eyes. The time will come when your enemies will build fortifications around you, encircle you, and attack you from all sides. They will crush you completely, you and the people within you. They won't leave one stone on top of another within you, because you didn't recognize the time of your gracious visit from God." Now, that was a pretty significant pivot in this text from what was happening before to what's happening now, but they're deeply connected in Luke's mind. So where do your thoughts go as you read that section of this text?
You know, when I first sort of read it and realized that he's, I mean, maybe I should check this with you, but he's speaking to Jerusalem,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I first wanted to say that I don't know how to make sense of that, to speak to a city in that way. But then I remembered, like I have said so many times in my years living in Georgia, that Georgia has broken my heart.
Yeah.
And so then I started trying to dig into like, what do I mean when I say that?
Yeah.
And it is sort of this like the combination of powers that be here, which is like our power system, our structures, our elected officials, and the combined force of individuals who can't see past their own situation, that it continues to be shocking to me, you know, over the many years that I've been here, that there are so many.
Yeah.
There's so many. And so I'm trying to read Jesus's heartbreak over Jerusalem in the same way that it's,
yeah,
you know, is shocking over time throughout, you know, the Hebrew Bible and New Testament, of the various times that people have not done what God had in mind for them to do. And what are the systems that make that happen, but also the genuine surprise and sadness every time.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. This takes me back. And I mean, I think it's supposed to recall for us that passage we talked about back in chapter 13, mm-hmm. where Jesus weeps there too over Jerusalem. Yeah. How often I've wanted to gather your people as a hen gathers her chicks,
yeah.
but you wouldn't let me. And that distinction that you're making between the people who are in the city and the mm-hmm. city itself, mm-hmm. which is reflective somehow of the collective will or the power structures or the governmental and political and economic structures mm-hmm. that are not necessarily the same thing as the will of the people.
Right.
And I think Jesus is making that kind of a division here, mm-hmm. but now he's a little bit saying like, but I mean, at the end of the day, right? Like the people do get caught up and there's nothing yes. I can do about it. Like,
yes,
I invited you to a different way and you didn't follow me on the different way. And so now this is what's about to happen to you. And I think mm-hmm. he feels bad about it, but he can't just, or he won't just, I don't quite know what the right verb is there, but he can't just like make the systems stop oppressing people
right.
without the people getting caught up in that intervention.
Right, right. The people have to somehow extricate themselves from that system. And
yeah.
many of them have not.
No, I think that's right. And then all the way through, like that last couple of verses, here's what your enemies are going to do. Mm-hmm. Like you can read that as here is what God is going to make your enemies do to you. Like there is divine retribution coming. Mm-hmm. Or you can also just read that as you are putting your trust in things that are not trustworthy. And this is what they're going to do to you. And it's not a, you know, it's not a divine punishment. It's a, this is the way of things. When you don't understand where peace comes from, violence happens.
That I really like that. I mean, it's pretty amazing to think about the power of these human systems to block our vision. I mean, even the stones, the stones can see.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And as you were saying, like, this is still true. This is still true in the world. Human systems are so blinding and all-encompassing that it is really hard to extricate ourselves.
So as we come to the end of the passage and we're trying to think about where does this intersect with contemporary life, where does your head go in terms of what modern readers might take from this passage?
I think I'm still really struck by the tenderness between the people and Jesus as Jesus is coming into the city, and the idea of trying to hold some tenderness for our leaders. Like it could be leaders of, it could be leaders of religious communities, or it could be leaders in any position. But I don't know. I just had this moment reading this text of seeing Jesus as so human. And I don't know, sometimes it takes that tenderness to see what's hard. Like it rehumanizes you to the suffering that's already there. Mm-hmm. There was this movie that came out years ago that I think many people saw called Life is Beautiful. Did you see Life is Beautiful?
Oh yeah.
And it's like set during the Holocaust, and it's basically a movie about trying to find some beauty through music or art or games or stories or something to humanize this whole situation for a child who's living during this time. And I hated it. I hated it because I didn't want to see beauty in the setting of the Holocaust. And I was enraged that someone else did, because it made it all worse for me. Like, I just wanted to turn that off and be like, well, a horrible thing is happening here, and I'm just gonna let it be horrible. And sometimes the constancy of beauty and tenderness is exacerbates the pain of it.
Yeah.
And I guess that's what I'm feeling. I'm feeling like the exacerbation of the pain of this story. And in some ways, I feel like this is, you know, this is just like me as a Jew reading this story, because I don't get the, and then he was resurrected, and now it was such a good story. Like for me, this just ends as a terribly sad story. And so watching it march forth to that point, I don't know, seeing this moment of connection and like love and care and humanity from both Jesus and the people who are with Jesus is painful, but I think also important, because I think otherwise it's too easy for me to say Jesus is the big powerful Jesus and, you know, and this is just what has to happen. But I don't know, those little details and that the connection that they feel with each other feels really real to me.
Where
does this text take you?
Yeah, I'm really struck by Luke's telling of this story in a way that is different from the way that it strikes me in the other Gospels. This time, I am really struck by this last little 41 to 44. And, you know, what we were saying, we've already said quite a lot about it. But that line, if only you knew on this day of all days the things that lead to peace, but now, right, here's what's about to happen to you. And Jesus has been talking since chapter 9 about how the people in Jerusalem are not going to get it. I'm headed to Jerusalem, and Jerusalem always kills its prophets, and I'm going to get killed too. And, you know, we talked about that before, as this is not about Jews always kill their prophets, which is how sometimes it's read. But this is about power structures kill people who challenge the power structures. Yeah. And Jesus is one of those people. And this sort of repeated, like, if you knew what led to peace, you could have peace, but you do not know. Mm-hmm. And thinking about the ways that we in our culture think about, like, how do we get peace? And it's about, like, you need to have a bigger military. You need to have more, you know, armed people on the street. You need to have more guns in people's hands. Like, you need to build fences around your communities. You know, you need to segregate by race and ethnicity and income. You need to have, you know, private schools that you can go to that, like, give you a leg up over everybody else. Like, the whole thing, when you start digging into it, seems like we do not know wherein peace lies. Mm-hmm. And Jesus, for this whole gospel, has been saying, look, like, it's in the Torah. Like, just read the Torah and do those things. Jesus has not come in this gospel with rocket science, right? And we talked about that all the way back with John the Baptist at the baptism. Like, what do you need to do to repent? Like, yeah. Don't cheat people. Like, take what's rightfully yours. Like, you know, mm-hmm. just live a life within your means. And then Jesus has been talking about, you know, the redistribution of wealth and the bringing of Jubilee and the resetting of debt structures and the bringing healing to people who are oppressed. Like, you know, these are things that are all achievable and people just do not have the will to achieve them. And this line about these things are going to be hidden from you. On the one hand, I think that's true, that there are structures that work pretty hard to keep us from thinking about things that might truly bring peace. But on the other hand, I think maybe we know. We just don't have the will to do it, or it feels risky to do it. Or this idea that got laid back out all the way back in the beginning, that the lifting up of some people is going to involve the pulling down of others. Mm-hmm. And those of us who have a high position don't want to be pulled down. And so we pretend as though we do not know. And yet where we're headed is to the destruction of our whole thing, right? The pulling down of all the structures. So to me, this is a very striking text and one that's very convicting. And for the kinds of kings that we welcome and the kind of power that we seek in our misunderstanding of peace. And if you skip too easy to the resurrection, you miss all of that.
Yeah. This is an intense story that your religion's got here, Bobby.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it is. Well, the next text we're going to read, Amy, is an even more intense story. Which is going to be our Good Friday special episode.
I'm going to have to bring my weighted blanket.
Yeah.
Like rocking back and forth with my weighted blanket.
Yeah. So that's what we're going to do in our next special episode is talk about Luke chapter 23, 32 to 47.
All righty. I usually say I look forward to it, but I'm a little nervous about that one. But yeah, we'll do it.
We'll do it.
We're going to do it.
All right, Amy. I'll see you then.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. Thanks for joining us for this episode of Bible Worm. If you'd like to hear the rest of our conversation about this text, join our Patreon at the Extended Worm level or higher to get access to extended episodes. You'll also find other goodies like early access, video lectures, weekly liturgies, and more, starting at just $4 per month. Visit patreon.com/BibleWormPodcast for details.
Bible Worm is produced by Bobby Williamson and edited by Joel and Laura Becker. Our theme song is sung by Colin Bagby. We are so grateful to all of our supporters for helping us keep the podcast going. A special thank you to our executive producer, Fox Valley Presbyterian Church in Geneva, Illinois.
Join us next time for our special Good Friday episode where we'll discuss the crucifixion story in Luke 23, 32 to 47. Until then, keep on digging.